Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. As we commence our fourth season, I'm honored to feature my heartfelt conversation with the family of humanitarian Paul Rusesabagina. We discuss the family's experiences during the Rwandan genocide, Paul's kidnapping in August by the Rwandan government, and the ways in which each and every one of us can help hashtag #FreeRusesabagina. This episode is incredibly moving, and I hope it leaves you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. In the spring of 1994, the Freedom Riders were dodging bullets and running from gangs. The Freedom Riders felt as though they were living in an undeclared war zone, but half a world away, a family of Rwandans was dealing with an actual atrocity like nothing the Freedom Riders or I could ever have imagined. The genocide in Rwanda lasted less than 100 days, but between April and July of 1994, nearly 1 million Rwandans lost their lives, often at the brutal hands of a machete. During those three gruesome months, hotel manager Paul Rusesabagina protected not only his own family, but harbored 1,268 refugees at the Hotel de Mille Collines in the city of Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. His story was adapted into the 2004 film Hotel Rwanda, starring Academy Award nominee Don Cheadle. And in 2005, Paul received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from the United States President George W. Bush for his remarkable courage and compassion in the face of genocidal terror. In April 2006, Paul Rusesabagina wrote a best-selling memoir entitled An Ordinary Man. Despite his international recognition as a human rights advocate, Paul Rusesabagina left Rwanda for good in 1996 following a failed assassination widely believed to be orchestrated by the then sitting government. Since then, Paul has become a citizen of Belgium and a permanent resident of the United States, splitting his time between the family homes in Brussels and San Antonio, Texas. However, all of this changed when on August 27th, he was illegally captured in Dubai and 4 days later showed up on August 31st in Kigali, Rwanda. In the years since the genocide, Paul has worked as a writer and speaker, spreading awareness of human rights through his words and presentations, while on his way to what he believed to be a speaking engagement with church groups in Burundi. Paul was kidnapped by the Rwandan government and flown to Kigali in violation of international law. He has been held in solitary confinement for most of his 6 months imprisonment. And as you are about to hear, his family is concerned for his health and his safety. On today's episode, we are joined by seven members from Paul Rusesabagina's family. His wife, Tassiana, his older daughter, Lise, his son, Roger, his daughter, Dion, his daughter, Anaïs, his son, Trezor, and his daughter, Corinne. Without further ado, here is my captivating conversation with the Rusesabagina family. Lise.
Yes.
You are the oldest child of the Rusesabagina family, and you were born in Rwanda. So can you tell our audience that will hail from every continent, every country, and every state in America, what your childhood was like being born in Rwanda?
I have got caring parents, and they brought me up with so much love. Until now, we are still together in Belgium. A part of them in America, but everything is okay except the kidnapping of my dad.
Before you came to Belgium, you experienced things that no child should experience. You saw things that no child should see. And heroically, you survived. And so as a survivor, what was that like leaving Rwanda and coming to Belgium?
I saw so sad things in 1994. I saw the genocide in Rwanda, and so many people have been killed. we have been hiding in the Milkolin Hotel because my father was the manager. Fortunately, everyone survived. After the genocide, the Rwandan authorities, the government at that time, tried to kill every Hutu who was influential or intellectual. So that's how my father was threatened, and he tried to flee the country and come to Belgium.
So Roger, as a teenage boy living in that hotel that became the basis of the film Hotel Rwanda, did you understand what was actually happening in your city and in your country when the genocide began?
I did understand, and Dad wanted to keep us away from all the craziness. We were not out in the streets seeing things live. We saw things on the way to the hotel, on the way out of the hotel, but when we got to the hotel, we did not see a whole lot. We had to go from our home, which was about maybe 25-minute drive from the hotel to the hotel. That was a very long drive, the longest I've ever experienced, where you saw dead bodies on the road. You saw people with machetes and people bloody. So you just had it constantly. That's all people were talking about. Even though, like I said earlier, that Dad was trying to shelter us from that, you couldn't avoid it because everybody who was in the hotel lost a loved one. Everybody in the hotel had a loved one who was outside just surviving, because we were living hour by hour. We're not saying, I hope I make it to next month. It was, I hope I make it through the morning, then I make it through the afternoon, then through the next hour, and then through the night. And we lived like that for, what, a couple months?
Now that you have the world as your audience today, what would you ask of those around the world to know about the situation, how they can stand up, how they can speak up, and how they can speak out for your father?
What he did in 94, he didn't have to be there. He didn't have to stand up. He was not the most famous person in the hotel, not the richest person or the most powerful person. He was not a politician. He was just a regular hotel manager who just decided, you know what, I'm going to stand up because the Europeans left. So we are left with just ourselves, and someone had to take the lead, and he did take the lead, probably the most dangerous job he can ever do. And no one asked him to do it. He stood up and did it. Got him a lot of recognition, you know, around the world, and a lot of people thanked him. People still, to this day, 26 years later, and they say, Roger, your father's a great man. You know, he did this for me. And some people who never even told me before, especially now that after he got kidnapped, I got calls from people saying, you know, I never told you this, but we came to Milkolin's, we had nothing. Oh, your dad helped us get to the Milkolin's. So, you know, I just, man, I wish I had told you earlier. And my dad, the way he is, he can never just sit around and see people getting abused and not say anything. It's just not him, and, you know, he can't help it. And that same thing that he did to help people, that's what caused him to get kidnapped. And now his rights have been violated. He's been treated like a criminal. Talk to your elected officials. Just, you know, send words of encouragement. Just write something on social media. I think just standing up for the truth, and then you can just act. Don't just sit back and let things happen and just act. It makes a difference. You can save a life. Your voice can save a life. I think people need to understand that, and the voice is very powerful.
Dion, as a child during this genocide, are there memories that you wish you could erase? Are there things that you wish you did not see or know?
I was young. I was in a primary school. I just remember how our parents, our father, used to call every morning, the whole day. He used to call in the White House. He used to call to the Elysee in France, in Belgium, to call the political to help to stop the genocide, to stop what was wrong, what was happening in Rwanda. But he didn't get help. He used to help everyone he can help. even the time of the genocide. So we as kids, we felt also how wrong was the situation. And we didn't sleep the night like another kid. We didn't try to go outside. Even if we heard some way or something, even now, if I sit in a room with other people, I never go past the door. I used to go every time so far from the door. We used to do like this. So if the military came, they don't find you. So this is something that stay.
So Dion, what you're explaining is the ramifications of post-traumatic stress that you, to this day, the things that you experienced as a child are still with you as an adult.
Yes, they stay with you. The kind of situation, even if you are a child, you realize that something wrong is happening.
Your father asked for help.
We are becoming his voice, because now he's voiceless. He needs justice, and the justice for him, it's not to go to the judge in Rwanda. There's no justice in Rwanda. The only justice for him is to come back home.
Ani East, you are the proud daughter of both Tasiana and Paul Rusesabagina. But what I would like you to share with the audience around the world is the family that you love, that is blended and beautiful, is a family of choice, a family that came together under the worst circumstances. So can you tell our audience about how you became the daughter of Tasiana and Paul Rusesabagina?
Our family is a blended family. And, you know, I think that's what makes us sort of interesting, but that's what makes a lot of Rwandan family interesting, because many families are blended. And you know, we heard about the war, the genocide, you know, where a lot of Tutsis were killed, but also a lot of Hutus were killed, and that broke down a lot of families. Unfortunately, it also broke down my own nuclear family, which where my sister and I, Karine, we lost both of our parents in the genocide because of who they were, because they were Tutsi. And so after the genocide, you know, my sister and I were alone. We had no family, but we were lucky that my aunt Tatiana and my uncle Paul took us in. They took my sister and I and have raised us since then. So, you know, even though I lost my biological mom and dad when I was a little girl, I was blessed to continue having a mom and dad the rest of my life. Many little girls also lost their parents, whether they were Hutu or Tutsi. And so, you know, what you see as a family here, you know, I hope it's something that will show you kind of what the Rwanda picture is. It's not a picture of only Hutus or only Tutsi. It's just blended families all over the countries.
I'd like for you to share how your mother and father, Tasiana and Paul Rusesabagina, really instilled what love was to you and your sister.
Love is unconditional. That's the beginning. Now, love is unconditional. Whoever, where you come from, who you are, love is love. And I think what mom and dad taught us the whole life is that, you know, never forget who you are, be strong, but also because my parents, you know, died during the genocide, doesn't mean that they treat us any differently. They loved us just like their own kids. They loved us like they would the of Trésor, Mimi and Saj and everyone that you'll see here. And we've also been reminded that, you know, it's through love that you can carry on life, you know, because it's very difficult what our family went through. And without the support, without the unconditional love in our family, you know, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't be real blended, glued together family, right? And so if anybody has parents like that, you know, you can assure yourself that you're also really lucky.
Trezor, your sister Dion mentioned a trial. Your father was illegally kidnapped. What was that like when you found that out on August 31st?
When I found out, it took me a long time to really grasp the reality of it. I just didn't believe it. It was like a nightmare, really. And I was just waiting to wake up, really. That's how I can describe it. And it went on like that for a couple more days. You know, it wasn't just that day. It was the day after. I'd wake up and I'd be like, oh, wow, this is still real, you know? I mean, I guess the best way I could describe this is like, I mean, you have your whole body and it's like a limb is missing from your body. You know, it's like you're missing an arm or something. You feel incomplete. I still feel incomplete. I still feel like, you know, not 100%. Every time I wake up, I feel like something really, really crucial in my life is missing. And that's because it is. And I reckon that my brothers and sisters feel the same way every day. That's why we fight. That's why we're still here. Well, luckily, we have the dad that we have, a man who's, you know, I mean, as courageous and as brave as can be. And we won't stop until he's home.
Corrine, your father is a human rights advocate, and your father has traveled the world giving speeches to inspire peace. And your father reached out to you in August. He was going to do a presentation at a church, and he asked you to book an airline ticket for him. So can you take our audience to what it was like in August when you helped your father, and then your father did not end at the location that he was supposed to?
In August of last year, he called saying, I need to go to Dubai and just to look for good flights for him. I booked his return flight for the 2nd of September. And so I knew exactly the amount of time when he was supposed to return. And essentially, he got onto the plane. Before he flew to Dubai, I checked in with him to make sure he had all the stuff that he needed, that he had. When he got to Dubai, we lost contact with him on the first evening, and that was on the 27th of August. 3 days later, on August 31st, I was in Washington, D.C. with Anaïs, and we woke up to all our cousins, our friends and family calling us, saying that our dad had been, they had seen our dad on TV and that he was in Rwanda. We were shocked. We were not only shocked, heartbroken, scared, very, very scared, because we know that this government, this president has tried to go after our father for so many years. We know he's attempted to assassinate him. We know they've broken into our home. We know they've harassed him at events, conferences, human rights conferences, students' conferences. So we knew that if he ever, and he himself knew that if he ever went to Rwanda, this is equivalent to signing a death sentence for him. So waking up, seeing him in the news in Kigali at the Rwandan Investigation Bureau was not only heartbreaking, but it was terrifying. As soon as we found out, we gathered with the family. We tried to not only comfort each other, just the thought of any one of us being alone, it's scary to imagine. We gathered as a family to try to make sense of it, to try to figure out what the next plan would be. And so from there, we gathered an international legal team. And then we started reaching out to the US government and to the Belgian government, because he's a Belgian citizen, and asked for their help.
Tassiana, your husband communicates with you every day when he travels. And when you stopped receiving communication on August 27th, what was your feeling? Did you think there was something wrong?
We tried to send message to each other. He told me, what happened to you? I can't listen. I can't hear your voice. It was hard to talk on the phone. Then I sent him a message, ask him. I don't know why I asked him, are you safe? He said, yes, I am safe. I have the problem of internet. Let me call you tomorrow afternoon. I will call you tomorrow the afternoon.
that tomorrow afternoon was Friday, and that time the afternoon didn't come. And I have waiting for the call on 9:30. The 9:30, I didn't receive the call. The following morning, I wait until the evening. It was Saturday. I didn't see the phone. I was scared. Then I tried to call him. Didn't go through. I tried to send a message. Can't go through. And then the Monday morning, I was very, very, very scared. And my heart was beating. I don't know why. My friend called me from France. He told me, Tassi, do you see Paul? He's now in Kigali. I told him, Paul is in Kigali? He said, yes. She immediately sent me the picture, the photos where Paul was in front of the rib. And that time I was done. I was with my young nieces, who is now 4 years, and I really cried. And the kids said, Auntie, you scared us. What happened? Don't scare us. So I tried to stop my crying. Then I was done that time.
Roger, I can only imagine what it was like to watch your father so courageously stand up for people, human lives during a genocide, and how crushing that must have been for you to see your father in handcuffs and imprisoned. So as his first son, what was that like for you, knowing that your family was breaking, their hearts were breaking? Describe that feeling of seeing your father in the country you left, imprisoned. Describe those feelings.
It's tough to describe those feelings, Aaron. It took me a while to just realize that was happening. I kept thinking it was maybe just a bad dream and I was going to wake up from it. And like Trezor said, our cousin called me and called Trezor. I was asleep, so I didn't hear the phone. So Trezor heard the phone and he woke me up. And we looked at the images together, and he almost melted. And just for me, just even to this day, sometimes I take like a second to just even just believe that it's still happening. And because that's like the worst nightmare for anyone who knows us and knows our family. And like Corinne said earlier, the government has been after my father for so many years since he started speaking up against them, against their human rights violations. So, yeah, it's, and like any child or any human being, seeing their parent in handcuffs in a place where he doesn't belong, and that's something you don't expect. We always thought that something that could happen because of we know what the Rwandan government is capable of, and the way that my father was going after them, exposing all the human rights violations, we knew, at least I used to think, that that's something that can happen. But it's one of the things you just think it'll never happen. It's just somewhere in the back of your mind that it's a possibility, but when you see it happen, it's almost like being struck by lightning. And it takes time to recover from it. I haven't recovered yet, and I think I will never recover until he gets back home. Especially that when we all know that he does not belong there, he does not belong in handcuffs. He did his best to stay strong. He was looking at he was in handcuffs, but his spirit was not in handcuffs. And I think that was a good message for us to stand up and to stay strong. Because if he had been there crying, I think we were all going to be crying and maybe give up. That's why we haven't given up. I think that message that he sent us, that, I'm in handcuffs, but my spirit is still free, still with you. And you just guys have to pick up the torch and just carry it and do what you have to do.
Lise, I'd like you to describe to the audience about your father's health. I understand he is a cancer survivor and has hypertension. And what has your family's fears been health-wise since your father was captured on August 27th?
We are afraid. We are afraid. My father is a cancer survivor, and he normally takes 2 medicines per day. But from the day that he was taken, he spent a week without taking any medicine, and his blood pressure went high, and he could get a stroke. So he's still in bad conditions. We sent a lot of medicine via Belgian embassy, and they confiscated everything. So he does not take medicines that his doctors wrote. So that's also a big difficult. And also he lives in bad conditions. He lives in darkness. He stays in a cell where he's alone. He goes outside only 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes in the afternoon. There is no light. There is no light where he stays. We don't know what he eats. We don't know what he drinks. We don't know what he takes as medicines. He does not meet correct doctors. He gets only someone who comes and take the blood conditions. It's something that hurts, that really hurts. He calls only 5 minutes per week, and there are people around him. He cannot talk freely. That makes the whole family angry.
Dion, when you were a child, you were exposed to horrific abuse outside of the bubble of the hotel. And one can only assume that your father has experienced horrific abuse in his captivity. So can you describe what your fears are?
I didn't believe my eyes. I didn't realize really, because I thought this is impossible. My father is an old man. He's 66 years old. He is not a criminal. So I thought maybe I'm doing a bad dream. It can't be that. That's not possible. So the videos and the pictures, this will be a mistake. And I thought maybe they will realize they make mistake, they release him and let him go because he's doing nothing. And it didn't happen. I'm shocked to see that.
Ani East, when I think of the Rusesabagina family, I think of just that family, celebrations, big meals. And I realize that your birthday is the first of the year. And so you and your family have had to go through many milestones this last year that you traditionally celebrated as a family. And I want to know what that's been like for you, having these milestones, these holidays, these birthdays, without your father here to share that love and to bring the family together.
I think it's tough because these holidays are a little empty. It's tough to celebrate on the New Year's, to celebrate my birthday, to celebrate his favorite holiday without him. It's tough to have Christmas without him. Again, I think he was our glue. Mom and dad are our glue. You know, they carry together. And so, you know, when you have a piece that's not there, it's not the same. But, you know, to what you asked about, like, the love, you know, that he's instilled in us, it's still there. So we are surviving this tough holidays. We're thinking of him, but it's not the same with that dad around. We have to adjust what we do. We have to remember that when we're happy, dad is in jail and he's in prison in solitary confinement. So it's tough to be really happy for these holidays. But, you know, at the same time, we cannot forget that these holidays are happening, these milestones are happening too, because these milestones without him are a reminder to why we have to fight, to why we have to continue what we're doing and to get people on board to help us, because I don't want to spend another New Year's without my dad. And so I know how awful it was and how difficult it was, and I don't want to live that again. And so that just motivates me even more. And like, when I think of these holidays, these milestones without dad, we need to do everything in our power to make sure he's back so we don't live without him. And so, but you know, again, we are a big family, and I think family is the thing for us. Dad has always reminded us family is the most important thing. And so we still find ways to stay together and to support each other. And so for New Year's, I was so lucky to be with my brothers, Roger and Trésor, and my nieces and Julie, and to be with them and to still appreciate the little bit that we have together, because I know that Dad would not want us to be alone in these days. He would not want us to be crying, just to be commiserating about what's happening, but he would want us to celebrate as well. So we do it for him with difficulty, but we do it for him in the hope that next holidays we will be with him.
Trésor, your sister refers to your father as a hero. And your family has been heroically fighting since he was captured. And so can you tell the audience around the world the heroic deeds you have done for this extraordinary man to try to get freedom? And tell the audience the things that you, as a collective group, have been trying to do to get his freedom.
Just like my sister said, our father is an ordinary man, but ordinary men can be heroes, you know. I think that's his message. And we've seen him do, you know, the most courageous things. And, you know, and because we've seen, we grew up with him teaching us about life and about how to fight with our words, how to use our words for the best. And I think that ever since he was taken from us, we've really just sort of practiced that. And I think that as a family, we've done an amazing job. We're fighting tooth and nails every day. We're talking to Congress, and you know, we're talking to European Union parliaments. We're doing things that we never thought that we really could for Dad. You know, when people say that tragedy really just reveals who people are inside, you know, it reveals people's character. And I think that this, although, you know, it is, I mean, probably the worst things that could probably happen to our lives as a family, it's also, it's really shown who we are as a family, our character, and that we're, you know, we all have a little bit of his strength and his spirit and his courage and his skill for negotiation. I mean, I'm seeing it through everybody here, through Corinne, through Anaïs, to Diane, Lise, Roger. We're all his children, and it's apparent to see. And of course, we can't do this alone. That's why we're here. You asked, I think, a few of us, what's it like to watch your dad stand up to injustice? And I think, when you asked that, all I can think of was my dad often loved to talk about Bible stories. He always loved to talk about Bible stories. And of course, one of the main characters of the Bible was Pontius Pilate. And I remember him telling me about him one time, saying, you know, talking about Pontius Pilate, the man that oversaw the death of Jesus. He would always talk about him like, you know, he had the power. He saw everything happening. He saw what was going on. But Pontius is known for a man that washed his hands of all of it, you know? And this is the lesson, not only about Christianity or anything, it's about life, really. I think my dad decided he was never gonna be a Pontius Pilate, you know? And I mean, he raised us like that. And I also think of a quote of Albert Einstein. I think he said, "If I were to remain silent, I'd be guilty of complicity. If I were to remain silent, I'd be guilty of complicity." And I think Dad lived by those words. Through this experience, we've seen a lot of people stand up. We've seen a lot of people rise up and really just you know, fight for things that weren't about them, things that were bigger than them. And this isn't, you know, of course, this is us. We're here, the Recessive Begin a Family. We're here. This is us. This is, you know, this is our fight. But this isn't just our fight. This is everybody's fight. This is bigger than my dad. This is about humanity. It's about courage. And it's about fairness, really. It's about justice. This man who I call dad, I've seen him almost give up everything for other people his whole life. And so it rips me apart to know that this is what he gets, you know. But even if it wasn't my father, I was still being empathetic to whoever was going through this. And I just want to say, I'm always surprised by how good people can be, how good humans can be. Of course, there is no surprise when humans are bad, but it should be said that it's good to see when people do good. And through this, we've seen a lot of people donate, a lot of people, you know, call and support. And of course, we're not done. The fight is not over. Dad is still locked up. Dad is still alone. Dad still needs us. And, you know, I always say if he was out and if it was him, he'd be the first one to fight. He'd be the first one to stand up. You know, he wouldn't wash his hands of you. He'd get in there. I think John Lewis, the late John Lewis, rest in peace, he said, you know, it's time to get into good trouble. And, you know, that also makes me think of him. He's the type of man that would get into good trouble. He doesn't deserve what's happening to him, and I'm just appreciative that I see a lot of people willing to get into good trouble to get him out, and I just hope that it keeps going.
Corinne, you are getting into good trouble every day. You have made it your mission, along with your mother and your brothers and sisters, to talk to every government official, every journalist, every citizen, every humanitarian to stop this trial and to get your father free. So can you tell the audience about this trial and how we can help to see freedom for your father?
So it has been as tiring and sad and very, I mean, our hearts have been broken. Our whole lives have been turned upside down. And the fact is, like all my siblings said, we saw our dad do this our entire lives. We saw him standing up for people. We saw him standing up for justice, even in the face of harassment and intimidation and attempts at his life. So we saw him bravely continue to fight for the people, for the voiceless, for the people who were oppressed, and for the people who were being silenced. And now we're in this position where we are I'm sitting here in Belgium, my siblings are in Belgium in the US, and my mom, and we have the possibility, we all have not only the responsibility, but also we are in a position to be able to use our voices and encourage other people to use their voices. Because silence, as Tresor put it really well, is complicity. So we want to encourage everyone to speak up, because once you see injustice, you cannot remain silent. And our father never remained silent. In trying to rally support for our father, we've been talking, as you said, to deputies, parliamentarian, congressmen across the world, not only US and Europe and Belgium. We've spoken with people in Australia, in Africa, in the UK, in all parts of the world. And the goal there is not only to ask government officials, so everyone, we all have the power to send an email. It doesn't take too much time. It doesn't take too much effort. It just takes the will to send that message, because that message can make a difference. And to encourage everyone to write to their representatives, asking them to call for the immediate release and unconditional release of Paul Rusesabagina, because he was kidnapped without international warrant, without extradition, against international law, in violation of international law. So in order to uphold the law, in order to maintain the standards that we should all maintain of equality, of justice and human rights, then we should condemn these actions of kidnapping a man like our father and ask for his immediate release. The trial cannot be a fair trial because not only was he kidnapped, but on top of that, every single one of his fundamental and basic human rights have been violated since he's been sitting in that prison. He's being denied his rights to medication. He's being denied his rights to his chosen lawyers. He's being denied even the rights to a free and fair call with his family. We speak with him only 5 minutes once a week. And on top of that, he is currently sitting in solitary confinement in a dark room without light and without electricity. From 5 p.m. in the evening until 7 a.m. every single day, he does not deserve this. Not only is he a hero for having saved so many people during the 1994 genocide, but having continued to speak up for people throughout his entire life, but also he was kidnapped. He was kidnapped against international law, so he should not be sitting in that cell today. And so when we hear people asking for a fair trial, so asking for a fair trial legitimizes the kidnapping. It says you can violate international law by dragging somebody across borders to bring them to another country and do whatever you want with them. First of all, he will not have a fair trial. But on top of that, this is a man who has been trying to kill my father for all these years, who has been trying to smear him for all these years. So expecting any fairness out of the process that is coming forward in the next few days is a joke. It is not true. It's charade. And so when we ask people to help, we ask them not to ask for a fair trial because he's not going to have one. We would like to ask everyone to write to their representative and have them ask for the immediate and unconditional release of Paul Rusesabagina as soon as possible because his life is in serious risk and his health is deteriorating every single day.
Anise, I know that you went to Georgetown University. For those around the world, it is in the heart of America's capital, Washington, D.C. And you, as a resident of Washington, D.C. right now, have spent the better part of every day meeting with members of Congress, senators, the same capital that we saw with that insurrection is a place that you visit daily, advocating for your father. What has that been like each and every day, setting up meetings with senators and congressional members and the U.S. State Department members asking for help for your father?
First, I never thought in my life, even though I've been living in Washington, D.C. for almost 10 years, that I never thought in my life I would be there trying to get these people to listen to me. And I realized that, you know, we are able to have this meeting because of the hard work my dad has done over the last 15 years. He's not in Rwanda for no reason. He's in Rwanda because the president of Rwanda cannot stand that he criticizes him. He cannot, Paul Kagame cannot stand that my father has been telling the world and these Washington, D.C. folks for the last 15 years what's really happening in Rwanda. So going to these meetings with my mom and talking to all the senators has just reminded me the work that dad was doing, that we have to continue this work, but also it's enabled me to, again, to give me what he's done and his legacy has given me the strength to go to these meetings with and be confident that what I'm saying, you know, that they will maybe listen to me. And we're lucky that they're listening to us. You know, we passed a congressional letter that was sent, you know, sent to President Kagame that was signed by 37 members of Congress from the Senate and the House with the leading members of the Foreign Affairs Committee. And so, you know, I couldn't believe it could happen, but that's because dad's voice has been there and now it's our turn to use our voice for that, right? And so, you know, we gotta email people and email until somebody listens to us and somebody takes us in that room. And when we get there, we just do what dad has told us to do and has taught us to do, to say the truth and to fight for the voiceless. Today he's the voiceless. And they're listening a little bit, and it's working. We had a meeting with Secretary Blinken, I think a week and a half ago, which was quite amazing. You know, he reminded us that my dad, you know, his cause and his fight for human rights is what the United States also is fighting for. He reminded us that he wants the communication to be transparent with the government, the U.S. government, and our family. So that's just to show that, you know, maybe it gave me the confidence to continue forward, but to remind me, like, the hard work that we're putting into is giving to some results. So now we need to push even more the U.S. government to get, help us more.
Tassiana, when you hear the passion, the courage, and the bravery of your children, of your beautiful blended family, are you able to tell your husband on those 5-minute phone calls once a week how hard they are fighting, how much they miss him, and the heroes that they have become in his absence?
Of course. I told him that he's there, but he has behind the children that he have been raised. He raised them as they are now. He knows that his children are really hardworking as he have been raised them, and he knows that they are stand for him.
I think in the Paul Recessa Begina spirit, you know, his memoir was an ordinary man. Most of us think of him as extraordinary, but ordinary people can do extraordinary things. So, Corinne, you had been fighting so hard beside your brothers and your sisters, and you've experienced a victory recently with the Parliament of the European Union. So can you explain to the audience around the world what this victory means to your family for all of your hard work?
Yes, we've been very fortunate that the European Union recognized that our father is being legally detained and asked for Rwanda to not only provide the details of his details surrounding how they brought him to Rwanda, asked the international community to investigate, to have an independent investigation on his illegal arrest and detention. And this means that everything that we've been saying, all the help that we've been asking for, is our people are listening. People are realizing that there is injustice happening, that our father is facing illegal and it's being held unjustly. And they have spoken up. They signed all kind of over 650 people signed the resolution in favor of our father, asking for Rwanda to not only provide the reasons why and how he got to Rwanda, but that if he was brought there illegally, asking him to release him immediately. So we're very lucky and honored that they recognize what we've been asking for, but we need people to continue to hold, not only to hold the European Union accountable for this resolution, but also to continue to speak up for our father, because he is still sitting in prison in Rwanda illegally and his health is deteriorating. So we need help to save his life. But we're thankful to the EU for this resolution, and we hope that they will follow through in seeing our father's freedom.
Trezor, on Wednesday, February 17th, your father, wearing a pink prison guard, was trotted into a court in Kigali, Rwanda. My understanding is that for those that were watching in the legal community, that this was a kangaroo court and what most officials are describing as a sham trial. Can you tell our listeners about that court case?
On February 17th, trial officially started. They took my dad to court in what most people have called a sham trial. And I got to tell you, I'm very, very glad that people recognized it for what it was. A trial that shouldn't be happening, a fake trial. An innocent man just being trotted out there in front of the world for something he hasn't done, something he doesn't deserve. And that, quite frankly, breaks my heart. But the good thing is that my dad and his lawyer showed up on the 17th and defended themselves, and they did so quite beautifully. They emphasized on the fact that this trial shouldn't be happening in the first place. My dad was kidnapped. He never intended to be in Rwanda, to go to Rwanda. He has said so himself. It was a surprise for him. He is a Belgian citizen. There was no warrant for his arrest at all. They made that up. The international warrant that they said they had with the help of the U.S. and Belgium, well, they have denied that that ever happened. So the government of Rwanda has some explaining to do.
The legal community globally has been watching this case, and I understand that Amal Clooney, who specializes in human rights, and lawyers of that ilk have stepped forward to watch this trial. And what is some of the feedback you've heard from the legal community?
The feedback we've heard from the legal community is that this is a violation of international law, actually. This is a sham trial. Amal Clooney, as you mentioned, her and her foundation have been very, very good. They've actually came out. They came out and said so themselves that this trial had, you know, it just has no ground. It shouldn't be happening. And so that's basically what we're hearing from everybody in the national community. My dad doesn't deserve to be there. He's a 66-year-old man, and every day that he spends in there is a nightmare for all of us, for his family. We're not complete. He sacrificed everything for us and for more than just us, more than just his family. So it feels good to know that. A large amount of the community, of the international community, as well as Rwanda community, is with him. And I hope that he feels that strength where he is right now.
Trezor, in the last week, there's been so much attention to this case with incredible stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post. What would you recommend to listeners who want and need to know more? What would you recommend are some action steps that they can do?
Well, first off, I would recommend that anybody who hasn't listened to the podcast, the New York Times podcast called The Daily, about this case, listen to it. This is a podcast that's got a lot of people listening to it. So we're incredibly grateful because finally this is getting out there. Millions will hear this, but please listen to it. Understand who we're dealing with, who we're fighting. This is not a good guy. And this government is not a democratic government. It's one that literally feeds on their own people's fears and uses it to their own advantage to get rich, to keep power. This is what my father was fighting. He fought for people in 1994, before 1994, and he's doing it again today. That's why he finds himself there. So I would encourage you to just check that podcast out, check all the articles out. Also, please donate because unfortunately, without your donations, we can't fight back. So I just, first of all, I want to say thank you for everybody who's already donated. And just please keep spreading the word, keep sharing this information, and keep praying for my dad and sending your positive thoughts. I'm sure that he hears it and he feels it where he is, because when I look at him, I see strength, I see courage, and I see bravery. And I think that that's because he knows that you people are out there with him. Nobody can stand alone. And my dad is no different. He's an ordinary man. And he needs you. So please just be with us in this time of hardship.
So Trezor, can you talk about how unorthodox this particular trial that is being held in Rwanda?
This is a very unorthodox trial for one reason, because they're having to basically come up with ways to try my father because they weren't prepared. Now they're having these, I don't know how many, these 20 other people tried with my dad, and we already know what their playbook is. They're gonna say, these are his men, and my father made them do this and made them do that, all the way from Texas. They're gonna blame everything on him. That's their plan, and they're gonna bribe these people. This is how it works. We know how our government works in Rwanda. It's less of a government and more of a mafia. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of briberies. It's going to be a lot of lies.
In my father's honor, I would like to ask you to write to the Prime Minister of Belgium or to the Office of the Prime Minister of Belgium and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, asking them to stand up for their citizen that was kidnapped and is being wrongfully detained in Rwanda.
In my father's honor, I'm humbly asking you to please donate to our legal campaign. We cannot do this without you. We cannot fight without you. We cannot fight without your donations. If you have it in your heart, we would be honored to receive your help.
Well, first, I will tell the audience and anybody just watching us, your voice matters. Don't doubt that. Whatever you say, it matters. If you call your representative, you call your senators and tell them, I know a human rights defender, Paruso Sebagina, who was kidnapped. He's a U.S. resident, a Belgian citizen. He was kidnapped by the Rwandan government, and he's illegally arrested, and he's fighting for his life. And if you tell this to your senator, if you tell this to your representative, and remind them of who my father is, and remind them the fight for human rights, the cause that the United States has really been put out across the world, they will listen to you. Don't doubt that. They listen to me, so why not you, you know? So I would really, really, really love if you could try to do this and call your representative. It will help us a lot, and every voice counts. Every single voice counts.
In my father's honor, I would like to ask you for please go visit Free Rusesabagina on social media and on the website.
In my father's honor, would you please write to elected officials, your congressmen, senators, and ask them to put pressure on the Rwandan government so they can release my father and he can come home to his family and continue his human rights activist work.
In the honor of my father, please write to the Belgian and European deputy. Thank them for the fantastic job that they did. And please advocate for us in the social media, on Twitter, on Facebook.
In my husband's honor, please try hard, if it is hard, to write to Paul Kagame. Ask him to release my husband as soon as possible, because my children need him and I miss him.
I'm honored by our guest, Tassiana Lees, Roger, Dion, Anaïs, Trésor, and Karine, for bravely speaking out in Paul Rusesabagina's honor. Their family has gone through so much, and yet their optimism and activism is truly inspiring. My dear listeners, may each of us stand up and refuse to be complacent in the fight for freedom. May we have the courage to speak up for those who have been unfairly treated, and may we use our voices by calling on our representatives to demand the release of Paul Rusesabagina. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruel. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.